Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Joining us now is the author of American Politics on the Rocks, The Bizarre Side of American Politics, author Rich Rubino. Thank you for coming back on to Overnight America.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to do it.
I like that you can look at some of the many candidates that have thrown their hat into the next presidential election and go back and look at some of the other candidates that may draw some parallels. One of the interesting thing is we're seeing a wide variety of backgrounds of people. Some are finding themselves mayors of somewhat smaller towns in Pete Buttigieg, but we're also finding in the past, it's kind of an unlikely path to the White House when you talk about those who ran from the House. But we have a great example here in St. Louis with Congressman Dick Gephardt.
Oh, absolutely. Gephardt's really kind of a fascinating example. He ran for president really in 1988. He began his candidacy in all of 1987. And he was actually a relatively obscure member of the House. He was not, for example, a Speaker of the House. He wasn't a member of the leadership. But when he ran that time, he took the issue specifically of trade. He said, we can't afford more trade negotiations where American farmers are always losers, for example. And his slogan that year was, it's your fight, too. And he was trying to say essentially kind of a populistic message of the people versus the powerful, very similar to that. He talked about trade issues. He talked about economic issues. And he, as a result of his campaigning, he actually came in second place in Iowa that year. He actually won the Iowa caucuses that year and came in second place in New Hampshire. And he actually had support that year of some unions. For example, the United Auto Workers that year endorsed him. And remember, this year you had a lot of viable candidates. You had Jesse Jackson. You had Paul Simon, the senator from Illinois. You had Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts. You had Gary Hart, the senator from Colorado. So all those people, plus, you know, this one lone House member, and the House member does relatively well in that campaign. And then after the campaign, he actually uses it as a gangway to become majority leader. And then he becomes majority leader, then eventually minority leader again. Then he runs for president again in 2004. And when he runs in 2004, the expectations this time around were you have to win Iowa. When he ran in 1988, the expectations were just you have to essentially become in third or fourth, because you know you're not a major candidate necessarily. This time around, he's a major candidate, and him and Howard Dean, who actually had worked for him in the 1988 candidacy, it becomes mutually assured destruction, because Iowa is a state where they tend to like very polite type candidates. So as a result of them going after each other, John Kerry and John Edwards, the other two major candidates, Wesley Clark was not in the race at that time. I mean, would not compete in Iowa, and Joe Lieberman pulled out of Iowa. So John Kerry and John Edwards moved up to the top. Dick Gephardt lands up coming in fourth place, and then since he didn't meet his expectations, he immediately drops out of the race. But he's a perfect example of somebody who, you know, kind of came from nowhere, used his House seat, and found an issue in terms of trade and economic populism, and he was able to actually win the Iowa caucuses and become a viable candidate.
He's the author of American Politics on the Rocks, The Bizarre Side of American Politics. Rich Rubino here on Overnight America. Of course, a big name here, Dick Gephardt in St. Louis region. And it seems like there are so many backgrounds of where the candidates are coming from in the Democrat Party in the next upcoming presidential election. I was just trying to write down as many as I could figure out. And I mean, even when it comes to mayors, it's kind of unlikely to find a major presidential candidate being a mayor of a small city. In this case, you know, we've seen the large ones from New York City. They'll always be in the hunt, former New York City mayors, things like that. But then you have the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, that just goes onto a Fox town hall and gets a standing ovation, and he gets a lot of people talking about him, a lot different than the politician down in Texas who, you know, you see the media grab on to certain personalities like Beto O'Rourke. But, you know, the South Bend one, he seems to have some lasting power.
Oh, it's fascinating. This is a mayor of a city of 102,000 people. Mm-hmm. 102,000 people. Now, that being said, he has a lot of, certainly he has an Ivy League pedigree, you know, he has military experience. But the fact that he's going for this, I think most people would say that the more logical path for him would be to run for governor of Indiana, mm-hmm. and then you become governor of Indiana, you serve a term or two, then you run for president. But I think he's seeing, I think what he's looking at specifically is, he says, you know, politics is about timing. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama, for example, gets elected to the United States Senate in 2004. He wasn't even the front runner to win the nomination, but then the front runner to win the nomination, a scandal involving his divorce, becomes a huge issue. So eventually Barack Obama gets that nomination. Then John Kerry allows him to, says, you know, why don't you speak at the Democratic convention in Boston? He blows everybody away. And then after that, he says, you know, let me say unequivocally that I'm not going to run for president. My only responsibility is to work for the people of Illinois. But then folks like Kerry Reid and Chuck Schumer come to him, and they say, you know, I'm really afraid of Hillary Clinton getting the nomination because there's so much animosity nationally toward her in the general election. Mm-hmm. Why don't you run? Now, the logical thing for Barack Obama to say would have been what any other presidential candidate would have said, you know, I just got to the Senate, let me serve my time, and then I'll run. But Barack Obama was convinced at the time that it's probably the worst possible scenario would be to become a career politician, someone like a Chris Dodd or a Joe Biden who were running against him that year, who never gained any traction because people saw them as being essentially born in Washington. Barack Obama says, you know what, this is my time, I'm going to run, and he won. Or, you know, then Donald Trump 8 years later, he didn't try to run for mayor of New York City. He didn't try to run for governor of New York. He ran right for president, and it was his time that year because he had a message that resonated with Republican voters. I think what Mayor Buttigieg is looking at right now, he's saying right now, you know, people are looking for a younger face. There's a lot they're looking for. I have military experience. I'm going to be the first major Democratic candidate who is gay. That could potentially help me in the Democratic primary. He's saying I'm from the Midwest, and he's saying, you know, this is my time. And if I don't make it, you know, well, that's okay. I can run for governor of Indiana 2 years down the road, you know. And he's saying, why not go for it? So he's going for it. It's fascinating. There's another mayor, actually, Wayne Mason, who's the mayor of Miramar, Florida, which is a city actually with a higher population than the mayor of Stolpen, Indiana. But he's gotten virtually no traction so far.
Interesting.
And then, of course, you have Bill de Blasio, which is fascinating because this is the mayor of the largest city with 8 million people in the entire country, and he's failing right now to register 1% in national polls.
I want to talk more about some of the odder things that have been happening in American politics as of late with author Rich Rubino, his books American Politics on the Rocks. Always a pleasure to have him on Overnight America. We'll continue next on KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. In the book American Politics on the Rocks, you've heard him on the show before, a contributor. I always enjoy our time with author Rich Rubino. There's such a variety. It doesn't have to necessarily come from a political background. You don't necessarily have to be a mayor. You know, there's activists we've seen in there. There's businessmen and women that have been in there, too. One of the ones that interests me, you could even be exiled outside of the United States. John McAfee right now, I think, even hinted that he wants to run for president. So you don't even have to be inside the United States, and there's people that are out there threatening to run for president. And I don't know if he'll get any support. He probably won't, but that's what we're up against this next year.
Oh, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. It's like, remember, Lyndon LaRouche ran about 9 times. eventually, people would just ignore him, but, you know, he'd run again and again. And I remember when Bob Dole was debating Bill Clinton in 96, he was talking about how all the people that he had to run against, and people were asking, you know, why he was so down in the polls. He said, well, you know, I had 11 other people running against him. He said, all you had was Lyndon LaRouche, you know. It is fascinating. I think that people are seeing that it's interesting because, specifically, in American politics, experience isn't necessarily an asset. You know, look at, you know, I go back to that example again. In 2008, you had Joe Biden and Chris Dodd and Bill Richardson. Chris Dodd was chairman of the House Banking Committee. Joe Biden had been chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He'd become chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Bill Richardson was governor of Mexico. Before that, he was the U.S. ambassador to the UN. He was the energy secretary. He was a congressman from New Mexico. Those candidates never gained headway. The candidates that did gain headway, well, Hillary Clinton was one of them. And also John Edwards, who was literally a one-term United States Senator of North Carolina and spent half of that time running for president. And Barack Obama, who gets elected to the Senate in 2004 and spends his second 2 years of his Senate term running for president. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's fascinating. It's like, you know, the other thing is when you have an Ivy League pedigree, if you went to Harvard, if you went to Yale, it actually has deleterious effects on you in American politics because people see you as an elitist. The perfect example I can think of was George W. Bush, his first congressional run in 1978. He'd just come from Harvard Business School, and Kent Hance was trying to run as a good old boy. He was his Democratic opponent. And Kent Hance that year said, you know, Texas Tech plays a lot better in the 19th congressional district than Harvard and Yale.
Mm.
And Bush had no answer to that. Now, if you're applying for any other job and you have a Harvard and Yale degree, you know, you have that printed, you know, you have the scarlet H on your shirt. But when you're running in politics and you have experience and you have an Ivy League education, you actually try to downplay that. It's a different field than really anything else.
That's interesting. You know, plus we look at Vice President Joe Biden, who has been off, but is every time a poll comes out, seems to be the front runner of the Democrat Party right now. So of the vice presidents of the past, the ones that did not seek the ticket during their tenure as vice president, took some time off and came back, how many times do you see them getting as much traction as Joe Biden's getting right now?
That really never happens. Usually when they're vice president and, well, let's put it this way: if the president has served 8 years, then invariably the candidate who is the vice president usually runs for president that year. There are exceptions to that; Dick Cheney being one of them. The other exception would be a president who lost, and then, for example, Jimmy Carter lost in 1980. Walter Mondale ran in 1984. Dan Quayle and George H.W. Bush and Dan Quayle lost in 1992. Dan Quayle skipped 96, tried to run in 2000, never got anywhere, and dropped out before Iowa. So those are two examples. But usually, when a former vice president, that's when the former vice president would run. You know, one example I think that's interesting in history, though, would be, and somebody who I actually think is very tantamount, probably the closest thing you have to Joe Biden is probably Hubert Humphrey.
Interesting.
Humphrey ran in 68 as Johnson did not seek re-election after it was appeared that he was going to lose the Wisconsin primary to Eugene McCarthy, because of his support for the Vietnam War. So Humphrey gets the nomination that year, barely loses. Then he runs again in 1972. And Humphrey that year runs as kind of the establishment candidate again. But that year, the anti-Vietnam, the insurrectionist wing of the Democratic Party was really proliferating, and George McGovern, the senator from South Dakota, who began as a 200-to-1 long shot, actually won the nomination, and Humphrey that year lost. That's the last time a vice presidential candidate sought his party's nomination and lost. And interesting, because Humphrey actually tried to become what George McGovern was. He ran to the left and said, it's time now to terminate U.S. troops from Vietnam, because he knew that's where the Democratic Party was moving. Now, Joe Biden is not doing that. We saw at a speech in Philadelphia announce his candidacy this past weekend. He's not trying to essentially become Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren. He's doubling down on his message of unity. He's doubling down on a centrist message. I think what he's looking at is he's looking at the polls, and most of the people that, you know, are so vociferous on the internet that are on the social media sites are usually the ones who tend to advocate for the more activist candidates. That's why they're usually people that are activists in politics are usually either far left or far right. Mm-hmm. What Biden's realizing is that African Americans, Hispanics, a lot of female voters, union people, certainly firefighters, are not necessarily on the left. As long if all the other candidates can be, you know, going after each other, mutually assured destruction on the left, that leaves Joe Biden, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, Seth Moulton, the congressman from Massachusetts, and John Hinkelooper, the former governor of Colorado, as the only candidates who are essentially trying to run as a centrist, independent-minded campaign. And of those candidates, Joe Biden is the only one with certainly universal name recognition right now. The other candidates have to get there, and they might get there in the debates, but you know, he's really playing that, and he's saying, you know, I'm not going to get the activist bloodline of the party. I'm going to get everybody else. And right now he has a lane in terms of somebody who's got a national known figure. He's got that lane basically all to himself.
He's the author of American Politics on the Rocks, Rich Rubino, joining us on Overnight America. Do you get, like, text alerts, email alerts every time a new poll comes out? Are you really into it?
Yes, I do. Absolutely, and it's always fascinating. You know, the candidates are trying to get to that 1% threshold right now.
Yeah.
Because what the polls show is if you have to get this 1% in three polls, or you have to get 65,000 contributions, and that what I'm getting a lot of, particularly Michael Bennett, for example, in Colorado, I see he's all over Facebook trying to get people to give him, you know, a dollar right now so he can get into those debates. It'd be very embarrassing for a candidate not to get into those debates, specifically. you know, when you go back to your home state, usually people in their home state are proud of a candidate that actually is formidable and actually has a viable chance of the nomination. What they don't like is somebody running a quixotic campaign, spending an inordinate amount of time out of their states, or perhaps missing votes in the House of Representatives, missing votes in the Senate, if they don't have a viable chance of winning. And I think you're not seen as having a viable chance of winning if you don't somehow make it on that debate stage. So it's really a gamble for some of these candidates to get into the race. And I think, you know, they think somehow they're going to catch lightning in a bottle, but you have to really get into that debate. Otherwise, you're considered essentially a minor candidate, and the press usually ignores minor candidates.
Yeah. One last question for you, and I don't exactly know the history of this, so I'm curious if you do. We look out well before the election when it comes to campaigning. You know, we're a year and a half away.
Oh, yeah.
2 years, 2.5 years away, we're already talking about candidates, challengers. They're already out there announcing their candidacy. They're out there doing speeches. They're out there fundraising. Has it always been like that where, you know, 2 years ahead of time, we're not even halfway through the first term of the president that just won the office, and we're already talking about the next one?
Yes, but not the way we're talking about it. You see, it used to be, I mean, primaries are a relatively new phenomenon. It used to be, and I'm not usually the press doesn't necessarily didn't necessarily talk about it as much as the other candidates all had, you know, certainly plans. Anyone that's usually, I'd say, probably 70% of people that run for governor or senator, and somewhere in their mind is thinking, how do I become president? But it used to be that they were decided at the conventions, and then gradually there was a more populist movement that they would be that the convent that they would be decided that the elections would the primaries would be decided by primaries. In other words, you'd get the candidates would be decided by the primary rather than having him at the convention. And eventually you had both scenarios where, for example, in 1912, Theodore Roosevelt won most of the primaries, but William Howard Taft won at the convention. But if people were talking about this, you know, a year or two beforehand in terms of who they were going to put at the convention. And it also used to be the candidates like Calvin Coolidge, for example, the governor of Massachusetts, who had just been elected in 1918. By 1920, there were talk there, say, why don't we put him up as potentially a presidential candidate? And they were kind of sided in dark rooms. But these candidates didn't have to go out and declare 3 months before. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, for example, in 1960, didn't declare essentially till the convention after they'd gone through all the primaries. And then it was about a 3-day campaign. He loses, then he's not a candidate anymore. Eventually becomes vice president. Stu Symington, the same thing. So what you're seeing now, though, is the primary process is so drawn out, and you're seeing a scenario where there's no really where every candidate, I think, sees themselves as a potential president. They can envision some sort of a scenario where they can get there. And plus, you have a 24-hour news cycle now. Plus, you have the Drudge Report. You have left-wing sources, right-wing sources, political sources all across the internet. And there's not much to talk about in terms of policy. People enjoy, I think, the politics more than the policy now. So as a result, there's a lot more coverage of how this is going to play for the senator or for our congressman, how this is going to play for their political future versus what they're going to do versus what the policies are going to, how they're going to be implemented. And as soon as somebody gets elected as governor, people are immediately looking at it and saying, well, how would you like to become chairman of the Republican Governors Association or chairman of the Democratic Governors Association? And they're looking, they're saying, I take that post, then I get to meet a lot of the rich benefactors and I get to talk to them directly, then I run for president. And then they know who I am, then they can potentially give me money for a potential presidential campaign. It's really, I think, actually the most effective legislators for their districts are people like Hal Rogers in Kentucky, for example. He was chairman of the Appropriations Committee. They call him the Prince of Pork. You know, conservatives hate him, even though he's a Republican, because he brought a lot of earmarks to his district in terms of highways, in terms of medical centers, in a very poor district. It's actually the 434th of the 435 congressional districts. It's actually voted 80% for Trump last time. So it's kind of interesting how it's one of the most Republican districts. But, you know, he's somebody who never had any presidential ambitions. So he was able to spend all of his time worrying about how to help out his district, whereas a lot of other members of the House and the Senate, their immediate concern is, you know, what about ethanol subsidies? How is that going to, you know, why don't I support them because of how it's going to affect the people of Iowa, for example? So they become, you know, everything becomes based on that presidential candidacy.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot to look into. You're absolutely obsessed. I'm going to guess even when you dream, you think about poll numbers. I mean, it's nonstop for you. I mean, you're always checking out what's going on. In the book, American Politics on the Rocks, it's been out for a little bit, but if you don't have it, where can people find it?
Just go to Amazon.com or, you know, certainly find me on Facebook or go to www.polita-geek.com, but the best place, Amazon.com.
Perfect. author Rich Rubino. I always have fun when you join us on the show. You are a treasure trove of knowledge. I don't know how you know all of these things. You know what I should do is maybe quiz you on politicians. I bet you would score 100% on it. You just know everyone. I don't know how you do it.
That might be fun, actually.
We can try that sometime. Obscure politicians. If you have a database in your mind, it's probably overflowing. There's one of those little things that say, add more space. At this point, you've jammed so much
in
your mind.
There's a lot of stuff that's not in there, too. So
yeah.
You could embarrass me on that.
Rich Rubino, thank you so much for coming on to Overnight America.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
I think we're going to do a regular thing with him. I love looking at the other side of politics with him without actually getting into some of these heavier political discussions. It's just, to me, that's more the fun side of politics. Wow, what a fast hour and a half. Jan Jacoby in studio talking about Abraham Lincoln, Rich Rubino, American politics on the rocks. We got a lot to get to. We're going to check in with AccuWeather just past midnight with some of these major storms that are going to cross through our area on Tuesday. What can we expect with that? There's a story that I wanted to cover out of LA. A mother threatening students inside of a classroom because she says her daughter was bullied. Now, I got to say, that's pretty serious. I don't know why this woman was allowed to talk to this class, but there is some audio of it. It may make me a terrible person, but I was thinking to myself, you know what? I'm starting to side with this woman. It's an unconventional way, but I totally sympathize with her. Maybe I'm going too strong, but I'll let you decide next on Overnight America KMOX. I think I'm having the inappropriate reaction to what happened inside of a middle school classroom. A mother is seen going into the classroom threatening the middle school students accused of bullying her daughter. If you're a parent and your kid gets bullied, it's got to be heart-wrenching to see them struggle, knowing that it's not like back in the day. I'm guessing when you grew up, even when I grew up, I'm at that age where this wasn't phased out yet. You settled something, you know, you got physical, and then it was over, and it was done. And, you know, I think the schools, even when I grew up, understood that, right? They understood that was just a more classical, easy way to handle these things. But now with the way the internet has played a part in cyberbullying, you can have all kinds of really terrible, psychologically damaging things always bombarded onto your kid that it becomes so stressful and taxing that kids do very desperate things to get away from it. And some of them even do things that harm themselves, and it's really, really terrible. So if you're a parent and that's happening to your kid, I totally understand this mother's reaction when she decided to take matters into her own hands after the school decided not to. Now, keep in mind, I think there's two different ways to say you can't do that, right? There's one way where you say, oh, no, you can't do that. And then there's another way where you can say, oh, no, you can't do that. I'm leaning towards the second way in this scenario. There's no way this mom should have been allowed to go into the class and yell at those kids. But if the teacher's not effective, I can see why she did it. And inside the video, I can see the teacher is sitting there allowing this mom to do it, which I don't understand either, why this would happen. And she wouldn't go and address this problem with the other moms of the classroom to begin with. So this is in LA. Mother threatening students. Let me play the story for you. And let me ask you this. And by the way, you're invited to call. We keep these phone lines open. We've done a couple of different interviews. How do you think this mom handles the situation of her daughter getting bullied? 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. Some people are looking like she's a hero. Some people are looking at it like she's a villain. I think you'll be able to decide for yourself.
School officials say that a mother barged into an eighth grade classroom and threatened students not to bully her daughter. Well, tonight, the alleged bullying and the classroom rant are both under investigation, and the mother banned from campus.
She's a girl. Y'all are boys, okay? If y'all bully my daughter, if you look at her the wrong way, if you breathe the wrong way, send your mom to me. Sisters, aunts, anybody over 18, them all up. Do you understand me?
Okay, so she goes in. I should be laughing at this. So she said, you know what? You want to keep bullying her? How about this? Send your 18-year-old brother, sister, whoever it is, send them to me. I'll take care of it.
You know, she's going in and she is not putting up with these. Now, she didn't directly threaten these kids, but she absolutely went off on them.
This Laguna Niguel mother, apparently upset that some boys at school have been bullying her daughter, showed up in their Niguel Hills Middle School classroom Tuesday and threatened them to stomp it.
No messages online, don't post nothing about her, none of that.
Students say they were...
I wonder if this is going to have the reverse consequence. Well, you tell someone that's in eighth grade to stop doing this very specific thing. I wonder if they ramp it up, or is this something that's going to scare them straight? I'll tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. When you're in eighth grade and you're doing something that you know is wrong, and if you're a boy and you're bullying a girl and you think that's real, real, real funny, sometimes, honestly, it's the scared straight method that's going to get you to cut this garbage out. It's an effective method. You get the other mom in there getting in saying, you know, you are out of your mind. I'm telling you what, that is effective. So that's why I'm having a hard time with this story. I know it's not the right way to do this, but it's more of like, you can't do that. But I'm telling you, this is going to, ultimately, if the worst thing that happens is she can't go onto the campus anymore, but her daughter is left alone and not bullied anymore, I'm telling you, it might be the right trade-off. And I know it's not a... Here, you just keep listening.
We're a bit surprised by Christian Tinsley's rant and the free, let's just call them, butt-kicking tickets she passed out.
Y'all think y'all bullies? I'm a big bully.
She told us, like, to, like...
Okay, so... I shouldn't be laughing at this. So she hands out, you know how on Monopoly you get the get out of jail free card? There are these little cards. I mean, these are professionally done. She had these printed somewhere to make them look nice. There was some sort of graphic detail, like not like graphic in a bad way, but she went through like a graphic designer or something to get these things done. And she prints them off. And it's like the get out of jail free card, which is free butt whooping card. You ever feel like you want a bully? Come and redeem this card with me. Here, I'm handing them out. You come and tell me when you're ready to use this. Oh, man. She came in and she was prepared. I just, oh.
Tell our aunts or like our cousins, our sisters, anyone who's over 18, that she'll like beat them up.
This is the student who recorded the incident.
I think everyone was scared and like I wanted proof to like be able to show like, you know, something happened. Like this is what happened and have it on recorded like document, I guess.
Capistrano Unified officials say.
Yeah, I'm sure the kids were a little scared, but wasn't that the point of this all? Man, I got to tell you. I don't think these kids were ever in any danger. And I'm telling you too, you ever did something and one of your friend's moms set you straight? You thought to yourself, I am not doing that again. This is one of those moments. I totally understand what this mom's going through. Totally understand. 314-436-7900. The phone line is open. You're invited to call. That's the kind of the nature of the show. You're allowed to use that cell phone or landline of yours to contact us and contribute and talk to the rest of America here at 800-925-1120. Is she someone that's a hero or a villain? You like what she's doing here, or do you think it's terrible?
Capistrano Unified officials say she wasn't invited into the classroom and aren't sure how she got in there. An assistant principal escorted her from campus, but not before she left some students rattled.
It was actually kind of scary, but then, like, she just was, like, all talk, so I thought it was kind of funny towards the end, but at first it was scary because, like, some random person...
That's bad. It's some... They thought it was funny towards the end, so maybe these kids that are bullying the girl didn't get the message.
Person comes in the class and, like, starts yelling, like, I don't know what your initial thought would be.
The school says the mother did express concern about bullying last week, and they thought they had addressed it. But it appears there was some more bullying on social media over the weekend. Mm. They're now investigating that bullying and banning the mother from campus.
All right, so mother's banned. Gets the point across. She hands out the cards, redeemed for a free butt whooping. Oh, man. I don't know. You know, sometimes unconventional means, as in social media bullying, you know, these really gutless boys that are bullying this girl, these unconventional ways that are completely different from a generation that didn't have that available to them, sometimes call for more unconventional means to go and deal with these sort of things. All right, so I want to know what you think on this. I really do. We're going to take some of your calls coming up next on Overnight America KMOX.
Now it's Overnight America with Ryan Recker on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
You know, let's get some of your calls on this. We keep the phone line warmed up for you. In fact, our producer actually sits on the phone to keep it warm for when you call. Yeah. 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. I just played the clip from KTLA about a mother who threatened students bullying her daughter, taking measures into her own hands after the school decided that, you know, we're just going to let this behavior continue. Carrie calling in. Hey, Carrie, what's going on?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and say that as a parent myself, I think that what this woman did was she should be applauded for it, because I think in a lot of school districts, including ones that are in St. Louis that are major, there's not enough that's done about bullying. And sometimes you can talk to teachers and, you know, administrators and even sometimes other parents, and still nothing's ever done. So, you know, as a mother, it's your job pretty much to protect your child at all means if the people that you entrust with your children when they're in school don't do the job. So I think she should be applauded for it.
Yeah, what I can understand is if she went to the school first and this behavior continued and the school said there's nothing we can do about it, or we did everything we can and your kid's still being bullied, and knowing how serious this is and knowing how much love you have for your children, I totally understand her want to go out and take measures into her own hands.
We'll see.
And you know what, too? I don't know about you, Carrie. A rant like that would have scared me straight when I was a kid, and it would have got the job done if I was one of those kids.
Well, see, that's the thing is, I'm almost 50 years old, and I know that when I was in school, like, bullying, you just, I mean, yeah, you got picked on a little bit, but I think also, I mean, as much as I hate to say this, that, you know, when I was growing up, I think that kids had, like, thicker skin, and we were able to handle things sometimes a little bit, you know, better than most of the younger generation. And I mean, I hate to say that, but that's just the way that it is. And as a parent that's raising a child in the younger generation, I realize that that's a reality. So I've had to teach my kids at home what to do, you know, if they're bullied in class.
Yeah.
And my son was actually being bullied, and had the kid brought a knife to school and was threatening my child at the bus stop. And my son fought back. And my son ended up being the one that got suspended, and then they were going to kick him out of school.
Wow.
For that, yes. So then I, as his parent, I was very good friends with the superintendent of schools. So I had to go over all the principal's heads to get to the superintendent and told him, well, if my son's going to be suspended for defending himself for being bullied, then I want to know what's going to happen to this boy.
Wow. You know, Carrie, I don't even know if it's a thick skin thing. And I do believe that things were absolutely different when, even when I was younger, when you were younger now, this whole different generation of kids that are growing up today. Imagine with the internet being piped right into the house, everyone having, you know, smart devices and being able to communicate with other kids at that age. Now, the equivalent would be, imagine if a bully came into your house every day and was doing this, like, face-to-face with your kid. Obviously, you would do something about it. It's just the access to bully has changed. So I think that's also made it so it's harder for some of these kids to combat these things, because they get into these other people's heads. And psychologically speaking, it's a really difficult thing to stop, even if you don't physically see it in front of them.
Right. I mean, I agree with that. I believe that, too, with social media, they have so many means to be able to to do it. And they can spread rumors and, you know, do whatever they want to, you know, say or do on social media. And really, most of the time, most of these, I would call them so-called parents, don't really, like, monitor what their kids are doing.
Oh, yeah.
And my kids are older now. My kids are, you know, 25 and 20. But I will say that when they were younger, they had to earn the right to have internet access, all of those things. And if I didn't have passwords to their social media accounts, then they didn't have access either.
Yeah.
We cut all access to it. So I just think that a lot of parents in today's society just aren't as involved in their kids' lives, and that's why this is a serious problem, and that's why that lady had to take drastic measures into her own hands to protect her child.
So you get it.
I mean,
I get it. You get it. Yeah.
Nobody's right. even saying, and nobody is saying, are they, that she's gone to the school and they did everything they could do to protect her child?
Yeah, they,
I mean, I'm
they
not hearing
hit it.
That.
They hit it at the very end of that story. They mention it, that she went to the school the week before and they said, oh, we tried. And she said, no, that's not enough. So that's when she took
oh,
it.
See, that's enough. See, I would, yeah. I would be done too.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Carrie, good call. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you, sir.
Bye. Let me get to Mike calling in. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
How are you doing about that lady?
Yeah.
Now I understand. I sympathize with her, but she was still wrong. Mm-hmm. You went over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't blame her for feeling that way, but it's not her job. It's not her responsibility. But the school city did something about it. I agree with that. And like counseling, because you can't just do that to all the students in there, but printing who the bully is to cause the problem. Because when I was young, I got spanked. Now, when I went to school, I don't know if you ever heard stories like this. Even in high school, there's times you did something wrong. They did do something about it. They actually take you out to the wall and whip you with a big, fat baseball bat.
In high school? Wait, did you ever get hit by a baseball bat in high school?
No, not me, but I seen it. It was above my eye. And if they acted up, a big teacher with big arms, if you acted up, you got punished, you went right against the wall. You know, a wiffle baseball bat, a real big fat one, and wham, against the wall.
A wiffle bat. We're not talking about a Louisville slugger here.
No, a wiffle bat, but it's enough to hurt me.
Whoa.
But, I don't think it's allowed anymore, but you imagine you see against the wall. But it actually happened. But I think the abuse part is wrong, but I understand her frustration about
So you sympathize with this woman, but you say, no, this never should have been done this way.
Yeah, she handled it wrong.
All right.
I can see that being a mother, but at the same time, the school should have done something about it.
You got
they
it.
Shouldn't just let it go.
All right, good to hear.
It's just suspended that person.
Hey, it's good to hear from you, Mike. Thank you for calling in.
Bye-bye. Bye.
All right. You know, we're going to catch up with AccuWeather here in a moment, and I will take some more of your calls on this. Wow. All right, some interesting reactions so far here on KMOX.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.